Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast.
Simply flooded the system with money.
Yes, we did.
Where does it come from? Do you just print it?
We print it digitally.
When you give people money that don't need it, they feel like they're playing with the house's money. So it actually does resemble a casino.
Give me some of that. Give me some of that money. I want some of that money.
Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is your host, Todd Zempel. And today on the podcast, we have a very special guest, Jonathan Ricketts from Natixis. Say that 10 times fast. Now, Jonathan is a longtime friend of the firm. He's an absolute professional, very bright guy. So, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you guys having me on board today.
Absolutely. Now, Jonathan, for our listeners, before we get into it, can you provide a little background on yourself and Natixis?
Sure. As you mentioned, I work for a firm called Natixis. If it doesn't easily roll off the tongue, that's okay. It's my 17th year there, and I think my mom still can't pronounce the name, but it's a really interesting organization. And as I mentioned, I've been here for so long, and what makes it so unique is the fact that it's not just one single fund family. Essentially, Natixis will go out and distribute for top-tier institutional money managers, names like Loomis Sayles, like Oakmark, WCM, Morova. I won't go through all 20 for time's sake, but it is very interesting as generally these folks focus on one or two very specific things, and then we give them essentially distribution to top-tier advisors such as yourself and your group.
Wow. You are just too kind, Mr. Ricketts. At any rate, the main reason I wanted you on the podcast today was not to talk about all the very interesting and thoughtful managers that you as Natixis have under your umbrella, but I wanted you to focus some time on the interesting things that you guys are doing in the target date fund space. Can you start there? Provide a little background on the target date funds and how you view that world, please.
Yeah, love to, Tom. Thanks for asking. So we at Natixis launched a target date almost 5 years ago to the day. And in preparation for that launch, we had the benefit of somewhat being late to the game. There's a lot of great target date providers that have been doing it for really 15 plus years before we launched the solution. But it gave us the opportunity to take a step back and look and see the market, look at the demographics, look at where we could be different. Because ultimately, what both us on the investment management side and you on the relation management and participant management side, overall, ultimately trying to do is help people become more retirement ready and move from their generating income from their job to then generating income from their investments and what they've put away in Social Security. And what we saw were some very interesting shifts, not only in the market, but also in terms of demographics of who's in the workplace. And maybe I'll start with the market first and a little bit of a history. Back in 1975, 80% of the S&P valuation was tangible. And what I mean by that is the buildings, the machinery, the inventory. And where you got a stock price, essentially, was doing a discounted cash flow analysis of those assets and deciding, you know, what kind of multiple you want to put on that. And that basically got to the stock valuation. Well, over time, companies changed. Their products changed. Valuation changed. And in 2020, that number flip-flopped, where it was no longer 80% was tangible, but actually only 10% was tangible. 90% of the S&P valuation in 2020 was intangible. These are things like intellectual property, branding, thought leadership. And I say that because when you can't touch and feel something, and frankly see a discounted cash flow analysis to that, you really need to be looking at what goes into branding and how quickly those things can change in valuation. So when we launched our target date suite, we saw that the market was changing. We saw that the workforce is changing. 65% of plan participants today in 2022 are 35 and under. And in 2025, that number is 75% of plan participants are 35 and under. So under that same guise of we're trying to engage employees with benefits, and being that at a younger workforce and the market is looking at very different things, we decided that we needed to create a product that catered to that, that catered to the fact that the market was looking at things like resource efficiency, rules and regulation changes coming down the pipeline, company waste. Companies are looking at corporate culture more and more now because, as I talk to a lot of plan sponsors and HR specialists, your next new hire is generally going to Google search your company. And they're, as the next new hire has options, they're generally going to want to work for companies that they see themselves at long term and that it's a good working environment. So corporate culture is very much a human capital conversation that goes into the marketplace. Looking at things like workplace safety, as that increases your cost of goods sold and above average workplace incidents leads to a higher insurance. We saw some notable companies have issues with that last year. What are companies doing with consumer privacy data? I don't need to name names, but there's definitely companies that are much more protective of their own consumers and what and where that data goes. And there's those companies that aren't. And we're seeing very much this year a very dispersion, or wide dispersion, between those names, those that are willing to do business with companies that are protective and those that are not. Looking at companies in terms of our boards along with shareholders, and what are companies' diversity inclusion practices. So the marketplace itself is changing, and we started incorporating those factors in our own asset managers that we're hiring for the target dates and with their decision-making process. Now, the market defines that as ESG, or environmental, social, and governance. Frankly, we're just looking at it as, hey, these are factors that very much go into valuation, and we really better keep up with that trend in order to ultimately come up with a product that is suited for today's marketplace, not one that's 15, 20 years ago in the rears, like some others that are out there.
Now, Jonathan, when I talk to people about this type of investing, folks tend to get a little bit nervous that they would potentially be leaving some upside performance on the table if they are using some of these factors for selecting individual investments. Can you speak to results and performance in terms of ESG investing?
Sure. And as I talk to both advisors and plan sponsors, that generally comes up with one of their first questions, right? We don't necessarily want to give up performance by maybe looking at these things that are aligned with our age group and our demographics, or even our own business mission statements. So, you know, maybe I'll take a half step back before I talk about performance and just mention that to get to really great performance and to utilize ESG factors, you can't do that in a vacuum. And I say that in two ways. You can't get to great results by looking at financials alone, because heck, it could be a really great company with wonderful financials, but their business model is slowly dying, or their product line has a finite time. So looking at financials in a vacuum, looking at ESG factors in a vacuum, is somewhat dangerous, we feel, but combining the two gives you a much more holistic view of the company. And it leads to your question around performance. Yes, the target date series, frankly, has outperformed a good majority of the peer group, but even more so because performance is fleeting, right? It's backwards looking. It's the risk that we took to get there in different market cycles, be that the taper tantrum like we're having right now, and what that's generally defined, or what that was, is back in 2018 when the Fed started to raise rates, similar to what they're doing right now. The target date series held on to a good percent of their performance gains over the benchmark. Or when very more recently, when we all went into that 2-week quarantine that seemed to last for 2 years, and the market pulled back substantially, we were able to hold on to a good part of the gains that occurred in the up market. So yeah, the performance has been really good. But again, we are trying to align ourselves with where valuation is coming from in this marketplace, which again, the way we are utilizing ESG factors, very somewhat commonsensical. You know, these are things that it's hard to argue that don't come into play when looking at the future opportunities of the company's work.
Now, Jonathan, a lot of our plan sponsor clients, they're on board, right? They see the value in investing in this manner, investing in companies that satisfy these ESG sort of guidelines. But we do get some hesitation when we propose potentially adding these funds as the default investment into a retirement plan. Obviously, there's a lot of fiduciary considerations that go along with making that decision. There's also been some Department of Labor guidance on the topic. Can you speak to just generally the fiduciary considerations and thoughts that plan sponsors should consider when selecting an ESG-friendly default investment fund?
Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of when we start talking about ESG as a whole, we're the advisor like yourself and Joe come into play that are really going to be doing a deep dive in these investment options. Where that becomes very important is there's a lot of gray area. How do we define ESG and how are we implementing it versus the other asset managers that are out there that may have a very different approach? So several years ago, almost 2.5 years ago now, the Department of Labor came out and said ESG options should not be utilized in a plan, and specifically not as a default option. QDIA, qualified default investment option there. And the reason being is somewhat of a knee-jerk reaction to how much demand and interest was in that space. And ultimately, the Department of Labor wanted to make sure that things still followed ERISA guidelines and that participants weren't necessarily buying into something that they didn't understand. And we understand that conversation completely. There are parts that we would agree with within the umbrella of ESG that really shouldn't be in an ERISA-guided plan. And maybe I'll break it down into five major areas and maybe start with the two that we don't use in our target date. The first being a negative screen or social responsible, which I think a lot of us are somewhat familiar with, or SRI. Generally, this came from the 40s and 50s and religious groups that wanted to make sure that they were not investing in very specific parts of the marketplace. The problem with over time is the exclusions, they grew, right? And we're still trying to make very diversified portfolios. And what one organization doesn't want to invest in may be very different than another organization. We don't invest in a social responsible type of way because there's no real investment thesis. You're just pulling, you know, big sectors of the market out, which leads to diversification issues and performance issues. Now, we generally won't invest in a lot of those same businesses, but it's not because of that we're excluding them. It's because there's business risk around them where we look not just in the next year, but, you know, frankly, a longer term outlook on those firms, which we truly believe there may not necessarily be economic opportunity for them. The other area that we will not invest in that still falls underneath that umbrella of ESG is impact investing. And impact investing has gotten really, really big for most individual clients that want to invest with a purpose. And I think it's commendable. Impact investing, we're defining it as basically Jonathan Ricketts wants to impact some kind of a social good. The problem with that is, again, in an ERISA plan, generally those investments are analyzed on the impact that it made on that social good, not necessarily the return or the risk that it took to get there. So again, the demand for those kind of investments is very high right now, but we don't implement that in our current target date strategy based on that same Department of Labor guidelines that you're talking about. So what do we do? And where do we feel as though we're very much aligned with previous guidance of the Department of Labor, as well as some of the updates that they've given this year. But we take a very pragmatic approach. We're using ESG integration with traditional managers that are just asking some additional questions, that are digging a little bit deeper, may find things that on a base level where, this is a great company from financials and where we think the future is. But when there's specific factors that they start to look additionally and what's going on, with their vendors or their distributors and what they say about the company, does it align? So we're integrating these kind of ESG factors into traditional asset managers, and that's where you get the names that make it to the portfolio. The next thing we're going to do, because our target date is actually both active and passive, we will use some of the rating agencies like MSCI or Sustainalytics, where passively we're replicating an index, where we're trying to make sure that our whole target date solution is very diversified and filling any kind of gaps that an active manager wouldn't fill. So we're using a passive solution, but is screened positively for high, high ranking ESG names that replicate that index. And then finally, the last thing that we're doing within this ESG umbrella is sustainability themed investments, where there are global macro events that are happening that are disrupting marketplaces as a whole, from the aging population, the growth in the middle class, the emerging markets, some of the more sustainability themed investment ideas. I won't go through all the different trends that some of our managers are following, but you can really take advantage of the opportunity that's in this marketplace, not just for today, but as we transition so much, both socially and economically, into a new economy, there's investment opportunities and pitfalls that some of our managers will kind of use that as their guideline around ESG options. But where we sit today in 2022, much of the guidance that the Department of Labor gave in the past has been rolled back, because I think they themselves have done a lot of exploratory questioning around what is this space, and maybe not taking necessarily the knee-jerk reaction that you have to give up performance to invest in these ways. And I think they further understood the benefits of ESG options. And ultimately, going back to what both you and I are trying to do and getting someone retirement ready, heck, if participants want these things and willing to invest more in these options, then that's terrific. And we've seen, and I shared this with you and Joe and your whole team, that we are seeing an increase in deferral rates in a lot of the companies that our solution's been implemented in.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. So Natixis is one of just a few fund companies that offer ESG target date or default investment funds. There's a lot of other companies out there that offer ESG-friendly investment options, but you're one of just a couple that actually use the strategy in a managed target date fund solution. And that's really important because, as you and I and other people in the industry know, that your average 401k plan investor, typically 7 to 8 out of 10 people will invest in that target date fund and stay there. And behaviorally, that's really important because if we can get people excited about investing, excited that they are able to invest, grow their money, and do it in a way that's actually helping the world, I think that we can actually increase participation. Now, Jonathan, do you have any anecdotes or studies that you can share with us that speak to that sort of increased participation when implementing this ESG target date fund strategy?
Yeah. To my initial comments that we launched 5 years ago, we are going back to the companies that we have worked with, obviously the financial advisor who has done their due diligence, and have asked, has it been impactful? No offense against me, but there's a lot going on in the world. There's a lot going on in the economy. There's a lot going on within businesses themselves right now. And I'd love to say that every single plan sponsor that we talk to and every single participant is absolutely dialed into their benefits, their retirement plan, what they need in retirement, and how to get there. But that's, obviously, unfortunately, generally not the case. So, but we did go back to the companies that we worked with and were able to present to on our solution. And after they've been in the company's either option or as a default, asked if it made any difference, right? There's certainly demand, but did all those surveys that we have done through the years and hearing about demand, did that prove out? And what we are really excited to hear is that it certainly did. There was a company that I got to work with in Knoxville, Tennessee, that added our solution as the default essentially 3 years ago. And we then asked the company, they're nice enough to actually even do a video with us talking about why they selected us. But that was years back. You know, it was really 1 year into our inception. And they had responded back. Actually, deferral rates went up by 66%. They did not change their automatic deferral rates. It was a prime participant deciding that they would invest more based on this option. So that's an anomaly. And Todd, you could probably speak to this as well. Anytime you have a big jump in deferral rates, the question you got to ask is why? You know, because I'd love to replicate that with every company that I get in touch with. And it just leads to, you know, better retirement outcomes for participants. So we asked the participants, well, why this change? There was two very specific camps, and I'll give my cynical thought on what really happened. But a good part of the participants said, you know, I want to invest in this fashion. And instead of doing the research myself, I know the advisor on the plan and those that are administering the plan of the company have done the research, and I just decided to invest more versus having to search it out myself and open up an account and deal with the fees associated with that. So again, I'll take that on face value. But there's another part of the survey as we asked that same question, and plan participants said, you know, I never really logged into my account. And I've probably used this factoid ad nauseum, but nationally, less than 20% of participants ever log in to their retirement plan. And that for me is somewhat sad, because the folks, be that advisors like yourself or plan sponsors, they take painstaking efforts to provide the best platforms and solutions and tools available at the time to their participants to help them. But if you're not logging your account, well, golly, you don't see any of that. So what we did see is basically participants saying, well, I logged into my account maybe for the first time or maybe for the first time in a while. And they were greeted with something that is very impactful, and that is a gap analysis. What does Jonathan Ricketts need to do, not 40 years from now, but what do I need to do with every paycheck that gets me to that number that I may not have even realized of what I need to replace my income at the retirement age that I'm looking for? And subsequently, a lot of plan participants realized that they weren't deferring enough, and they increased with just several clicks what they were, their deferral rates, and selecting our target date if it was an additional option. So I find that very impactful. If I can help even just a handful of companies every month that are deciding to defer more from the participant level, I don't know. I find that wonderful. We've had a couple of different case studies with universities and some research firms as well, some tech firms. So it's as we're gathering more data, the longer we've been around, we really do find it really uplifting, some of the results that we're seeing. And part of it could be just because our performance has been so good, but at the end of the day, engagement is what we all hope for.
You made a big point in the past of talking about the collection of managers under the Natixis umbrella. Why don't you comment on a few of those for our listeners? Because many of them, you know, don't know Natixis per se, but they know some of the names that have a long legacy, both in fixed income and stocks.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we own and represent over 20, it's actually closer to 25 now, individual institutional money managers. So we brought on a portfolio manager to run our target date about 4 years ago, and he came from Fidelity. And he looked at all those different affiliates. And Joe, you're familiar with Luna Sales, the Oakmark Funds, We represent WCM, Morova. Again, I don't, for this, for a podcast, I won't go through all 25 names. But he looked at the list of companies that we represent, and he essentially called it his toolbox. These are all the different fund families he could select a best-in-breed approach. And you know where that's going to be different than some of the other solutions that are out there that use a single fund family. Think of it. You know, any one company doesn't generally do all things to all people. They may do a large growth very well. They may have a great international presence. They could really focus on fixed income. Maybe they've got a great small cap solution. We're basically able to select the best products from each of our affiliates versus a single fund family approach where there could be gaps in what they offer in their solution. There could be group thought as firms generally feel a specific way about certain sectors of the marketplace and areas they're going to under and overweight. We do think that leads to just more of a more diversified and more robust target date solution. And as we mentioned, Todd, in terms of performance and the risk that we took to get there, the numbers certainly are starting to proof out in that same fashion.
So one of the things that makes you unique, you know, obviously the ESG overlay, but also the multi-manager approach, which is very different than probably 95% of the competitors. Since you're up on your five-year anniversary, can you talk to us a little bit about your ranking relative to other active target date series out there and then relative to passive indexes?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I'll touch on the passive first, as I think, you know, going back to that, there's, as I do talk to plan sponsors, one of their big questions on the offset is, well, geez, are you giving up performance, right? Performance versus a peer group or performance versus the low cost option that they may be looking at as well. And on average over an index, and this is the S&P target date index, since we launched, and you know, I can give you basically the end of last year's numbers as this quarter isn't over yet, we have averaged over 200 basis points or 2% over our benchmark. And you know, if you can compound that over time, that certainly makes a real difference when we start talking about percentages and start talking about dollar amounts. So if I look at, you know, our rankings, if you will, compared to our peer group, you know, one of our top performing options ranks number 7 out of 117 different target dates. And then, you know, some of our, you know, again, it fluctuates because as the glide path changes, then you're ultimately maybe over or underweight different equity to fixed income ratios compared to your peer group. But you know, basically all of our target dates, maybe to sum it up easier that way, are in the top 25 percentile or top 30 percentile of the different target dates that are out there. But ultimately, Joe, that only tells part of the story. You could have the best performing target date out there, but over the last 5 years where equity risk was rewarded, the question is, what kind of risk did you take, right? As this market's gotten more volatile in the equity side, the Fed has decided to raise rates, so that gets a fixed income or bonds volatile as well. But we have one of the, if not the best risk-adjusted number on our target date as well. That really comes from, I think, a multiple fund family approach. As our business and the bedrock, if you will, that asset allocation is built on, is that when parts and pieces move differently, i.e. leading to diversification, if one asset class or one sector zigs, the other one zags, it ultimately also gives you a better risk number because you're not as volatile. Your plot analysis of returns has less variation in that. So pretty much across the board, we have one of the best risk-adjusted returns of any of the target dates that are out there as of the end of last year, which is important. You know, and I think is very important because it's you know, performance is fleeting. The question is, can you repeat it? We're dealing with, like I said, an investor class that has one of the longest time horizons to invest, and that's a plan participant making contributions every paycheck.
So the measurement you're using is that Sharpe ratio to determine risk adjusted performance and rankings. Is that what you're using?
Correct. Yeah. Pretty much across the board, we're either in the top first percentile, second percentile, or fourth percentile of all the different target dates that are out there, out of the 200 or so target dates per vintage. So yes, yeah, we use a Sharpe ratio, which is very basically a return over the risk that you took to get there.
Sustainability without sacrifice. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for sharing some insight onto the target date fund suite that Natixis has to offer.
I appreciate the opportunity, guys, for sure.
Well, if you'd like to learn anything more about Natixis, any of their funds, you can view their website at im.natixis.com. That's the letter I, letter M, dot natixis.com. Thanks a lot, folks. That'll do it for today. Please don't hesitate to touch base on social media.
My raps are raw. I dribble like a basketball. Slobber on myself with that.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to click subscribe. Gordon Asset Management, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit wealthqb.com. The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.